The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Lee Kunkel is titled, The Bradley Sisters Went Missing 20 Years Ago, and Their Aunt Hasn't Stopped Searching for Them Since. Just before dawn on July 7, 2001, Sheila Bradley Smith climbed into her 97 Dodge Caravan in the parking lot of a housing complex on the south side of Chicago. She did not buckle her seatbelt or ease the car out of park. She sat, watching. The complex comprised two blocks of apartments that bordered the south and east sides of the lot. The west was hemmed in by South Cottage Grove Avenue, intersecting at a diagonal with East 35th Street, which formed the lot's northern boundary. Across 35th was the low brick facade of the Sixth Grace Presbyterian Church, silent in the crepuscular light. Humidity had been building in the air for hours, spilling over briefly into drizzle just as the day broke and then settling, sticky and thick, over the city. The tip of Sheila's cigarette shone orange, framed by the metallic blue body of the van. Every person she saw, she wondered, was it you? Was it you who took those little girls? Shadows shrank, going from an even blanket across the landscape to distinct shapes that stretched across the sidewalk. Sheila waited, patient as a desert predator in the shade of its burrow, although everything inside of her was screaming, knowing her two little great-nieces could be getting farther and farther away. She watched the first city bus of the day roll through in the new morning sun, watched as the crossing guard arrived around 7 o'clock to escort neighborhood children across the busy intersection, watched the students from a nearby learning center disembark their yellow bus an hour later. She noted the comings and goings of the neighbors and their visitors. Was it you? Any one of these people might know who did it. Any one of them might have done it. In the late morning, she retreated to her niece's apartment for several hours, but returned to her vigil at 10 o'clock that night. She sat through the dark hours, smoking and sipping soda. The second morning, a truck full of men arrived at the complex for a carpet job. Old carpet out, new carpet in. Were the rolls large enough to smuggle two young girls out of the building? Probably. Diamond was 3 and Tianda was 10, and both were small. The two of them together weighed just over 100 pounds. But other than proximity, there was no reason to distrust the men, and having completed their work, they left without ever knowing that they were, briefly, in the mind of a childless aunt peering through the window in her van, suspected kidnappers. For the better part of a desperate summer week 20 years ago, Sheila sat in that parking lot hoping to see something that would give her a clue as to who had taken her great-nieces. But there were no meaningful leads that week, nor really in the more than 1,000 weeks since. It's as if time stopped when she climbed into the van on that humid July morning 2 decades ago. In many ways, she has never left. Establishing even the most basic facts of the case of the missing Bradley sisters is difficult, complicated as they are by time, trauma, and the complexity of relations between law enforcement and the Black community. Nearly every reported detail of the girl's disappearance has, at one point or another, been contradicted by someone. Making the pieces fit perfectly is impossible. There is always a jagged corner sticking out someplace. Reporting on Diamond and Tianda's disappearance is equally complex. Several sources, at the urging of a private investigator who has been working on the case since 2001, would not allow their interviews for this story to be recorded, and the investigator was also on the calls. Ed Carroll, a now-retired cold case detective with the Chicago Police Department, believes he was brought onto the investigation in 2009 after years of little progress because no one else wanted it, after Marie Begain, another cold case detective, left the team and another detective became terminally ill. It was that big of a mess, he says. So much had been done incorrectly in the initial investigation that they had to start from scratch, reinvestigating every lead from the beginning. In all the years that he worked cases, Carroll says, this is the only one where I couldn't rule anyone in or out. Much of the timeline that exists today is due to Beguine's work in organizing the sprawling case files and Carroll's diligence and commitment, even after his retirement, to pressing on. The family, too, presses on. It's a strange kind of torture. Each year, you know that the odds get smaller and smaller and smaller, and yet each year your singular hope, this might be the year, persists. So you hope and you hope and you hope. What else can you do? Around 4:30 a.m. on the morning of July 6, 2001, a man named Tom arrived at the apartment where the woman he was seeing on and off, Tracy Bradley, 32, lived with her four daughters, Rita, 12, Tianda, 10, Victoria, 9, and Diamond, 3. Note, Tom's name has been changed. Roughly 2 hours after he arrived, Tom drove Tracy to her job at the nearby Robert Taylor Homes, another apartment complex, where she helped prepare breakfast and lunch for residents. Rita and Victoria were at Tracy's mom's house, where they had spent the night. Diamond and Tianda were left home in Tracy's apartment with the same strict instructions their mother always gave them: don't go anywhere or open the door to anyone. Tracy called home three times between 8 and 9 a.m. Tianda did not answer any of the calls, which was unusual. Phone records also indicate that several calls from other numbers to Tracy's apartment went unanswered over the course of the morning, and there were two hang-ups. At roughly 11:30 a.m., Tracy returned home from work. Usually, she would find Diamond and Tianda spread out across the cream-colored couch, watching a show or playing a game. But that day, the living room was heavy with silence. She ran to the back of the apartment, calling out their names, but there was no one there. Fear rose in her throat with every empty room she found. When Tracy returned to the living room, she found a note in Tianda's handwriting on a lounge chair. It said that the girls were planning to go to a store and then a nearby school playground. The note is the first of several perplexing clues in the case. Because it is in the sealed possession of the FBI, many people involved in the case have never even seen it, nor is there a public record of its wording. Rita says today that it was Tianda's handwriting, but we never in our lives wrote a letter for our mom, and the girls all knew not to leave while she was at work. Many years later, some of Tianda's classmates claim to have seen the girls at the playground that day, but after so much time has passed, it's impossible to corroborate or know how accurate the information is. Sheila, who is Tracy's aunt, is also suspicious of the note. The way Tianda spoke, her grammar, didn't line up with the grammar in the note, she says. And another thing, she wouldn't have spelled certain words that way. They wouldn't have been spelled correctly. While it was determined by the FBI that Tianda did write the note herself, Sheila says, the question is, was she persuaded to write under false pretenses? Tracy made a flurry of calls to neighbors and family members. Her sister Faith picked Victoria and Rita up from their grandmother's house, and soon the entire extended family was fanning out to search for Diamond and Tianda. According to police reports, Tom, rather than help with the canvas, made plans to meet up with another girlfriend. They searched the nearby Ida B. Wells housing complex, where the girls had friends they might have gone to visit. They scoured the 31st Street beach, where they often spent hot summer days cooling off in the waters of Lake Michigan. They traversed the bridge over the busy expressway, hoping to intercept the girls as they wandered. But no one had seen Diamond or Tianda, nor was there any indication that they'd visited any of their favorite spots that day. Just before 7 p.m., Tracy called the police to report her daughters missing. At this point, they had been gone for at least 7.5 hours. The Chicago police responded immediately, which is, statistically and anecdotally, unusual for a case involving missing black children. The initial search for the girls involved three beat cars, two supervisors, and two canine units, which combed the neighborhood, including dumpsters, yards, vacant lots, businesses, and the lakefront. Eventually, the search would expand to become the largest missing person search in Chicago's history at the time, including involvement by the FBI and a tip line that brought in 824 tips, none of which went anywhere. To some observers, Tracy appeared uninterested in following up on leads in the early days of the disappearance. At one point, a surveillance video from a nearby store surfaced that might have shown Diamond and Tianda, but Tracy initially declined to view it to confirm. The video was ultimately determined to be unrelated. When police would go to her house with additional questions or to bring her information, she sometimes refused to interact with them. Even now, Tracy is difficult to contact. I was only able to speak with her on a conference call mediated by Pablo Foster, the family's private investigator, who requested that I not tape our conversation. But many of the criticisms others have leveled against her become less clear-cut when you talk to her. The decision to delay calling the police, for example. She says that most parents will never have to face the terrifying, confusing ordeal that she was experiencing and couldn't imagine what it's like. I just wanted to search on my own. I wasn't even thinking about the police, she says. Any parent would do the same that I did. When she speaks about the case to me, her words are alternately hesitant and forceful. Her comfort with discussing something so intimate and painful seems to wax and wane from moment to moment. It is a quality that does not lend itself to simple narratives of familial pain and love. People's rush to judge the quality of her grieving exacerbates the problem, and the cycle continues. Adding another layer of complication to the situation was the fact that, like many Black families, the extended Bradley family had traumatizing past experiences with law enforcement. When Faith asked Tracy earlier in the day if she'd called the police yet, Faith recalls, Tracy told her that she was afraid of being reported to the Department of Children and Family Services. There's a sense of distrust between the minority community and law enforcement, says Natalie Wilson, co-founder and chief operations officer of the Black and Missing Foundation, a nonprofit that works to raise awareness of missing people of color. If you look at what's going on now in our communities, it didn't just start. That relationship has been like that with law enforcement due to racial injustices for many, many years. The morning after the disappearance, when Sheila was on her parking lot vigil, Tracy's sister Faye says she decided to check the voicemail on Tracy's cell phone, which Tracy had not done. Faith had set up the family plan and knew all of the pins. There was a message from Tianda. She said, "Mom, Mom, answer the phone. Tom is at the door with the cake," says Faith. The whole family listened to the message, she says, as did the FBI agents who were at the house. Tom is also the name of the Bradley's neighbor and family friend. His name, like the other Toms, has also been changed, who was helping search for Diamond and Tianda. However, that Tom actually went by a distinctive nickname, which Tianda would have used. The consensus was that Tianda was likely referring to her mother's boyfriend. After that day, the voicemail seems to have vanished. Faith thinks it may have been accidentally deleted. Tracy says she never heard it. Sheila says it disappeared, but won't give further detail. Foster, the private investigator, was cagey, but intimated to me that the FBI has it. The only thing known for certain is that the Chicago Police Department does not have it in their evidence locker. Ed Carroll, the retired cold case detective, says he pleaded with anyone who might have the tape to share it with him. I told them I'd go anywhere in the United States to find it, but no one could ever tell me where it was. The tape could open up whole new avenues of investigation, he says. Another twist? There's no record of a call from Tracy's home to her cell phone that day. When terrorists attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon just 2 months after the Bradley's disappearance, media attention to the girl's disappearance dried up, and so did most of the leads. As the weeks went by, Tracy entered a zone in which it was painful even to speak. She couldn't do anything but sleep and pray. But the police were still working the case, and their search started to zero in on one man. Tracy and Tom had always had a complicated relationship. It was made even more so when she became pregnant with Diamond. Tom denied paternity. However, not long before the girl's disappearance, Tracy had demanded that Tom take a paternity test. The results came in just 3 weeks after Diamond vanished. He was her father. In the days leading up to July 6, Tom did something out of character. He planned a camping trip for Tracy, Diamond, and Tianda, even though the group had never been camping together before. Planned might even be too strong a word. Tom hadn't made reservations, despite it being 4th of July weekend, nor had he bought any food for the trip, and he had borrowed only minimal equipment, according to police records. The trip would have been unusual not only because of its novelty, but because Victoria's 8th birthday was the next day and she was not invited. Tom had never played a parental role in the Bradley girls' lives. At the time, he still denied he was Diamond's father. In fact, the girls rarely interacted with him other than an occasional car ride. "Why would he take just two of the kids camping when we'd never done anything together with them?" says Rita, who was also not invited. "He probably had something up his sleeve. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to see." Tom has never been charged with anything relating to the girls' disappearance. On July 7th, the day after the disappearance, receipts indicate that Tom bought a package of 42-gallon contractor bags, gardening gloves, and a pair of neoprene protective gloves. When police searched his home several days later, there were 5 bags missing from the roll, and the gardening gloves were not found. A neighbor said they had seen Tom burning something in a 55-gallon drum, and several others noted they had seen him loading it into the trunk of his car, returning approximately 45 minutes later. Tom denied that these events took place, but FBI reports note evidence of charring on the rafters of his garage, as well as striations in the trunk that match the size and shape of a trash barrel. If what was in the barrel was related to Diamond and Tianda's disappearance, Carol says, it was likely only their clothing, because neighbors would not have been able to forget the distinctive smell of a burning body. Also found in Tom's trunk was a blanket containing several hairs later determined to belong to Tianda. Tom claimed that he had taken Tracy and her daughters to a drive-in movie and made Tianda and Diamond hide in the trunk so that he would not have to pay for their tickets, something that Rita vehemently denies ever happened. The logistics are also questionable. Only one drive-in theater was operational in Chicagoland at the time, nearly an hour away. Tom was a prolific cell phone user, even in 2001. Beginning at 4:30 a.m. on July 6th, he made at least 40 phone calls over a period of 24 hours. There are 2 stretches during which he called no one, from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m., immediately after he dropped Tracy off at work, and while the girls are presumed to have been alone in the apartment, and from 5 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. His calls preceding the second window pinged off of cell towers on the far south side of the city, near multiple forest preserves and the Little Calumet River. At one point, Tracy reportedly told her cousin that if Tom did do something to those kids, they may be where he used to take me walking in the forest. As he worked on the case in the early 2010s, Carol made sure to always loop in the office of Anita Alvarez, then the state's attorney for Cook County, to ensure that they were aware of any updates or new information. He hoped that the office might decide to convene a grand jury. "I always thought it could shake something loose from the trees," he says. "People make mistakes when they're under pressure, even years after the fact." Alvarez's office never moved forward, though. The goal of a grand jury is to establish whether to bring criminal charges or an indictment against someone. It does not have the power to convict anyone. But its benefits can be particularly important in a situation like the Bradleys, with so many complexities and moving pieces. Grand juries can subpoena witnesses who might otherwise refuse to speak to law enforcement, and because their testimony is sealed, also offer them a degree of protection that it can encourage them to be more forthcoming. In the Bradley's case, convening a grand jury can not only help determine if and when the case is sufficient to move forward to criminal court, but would also have the advantage of getting witnesses' testimony on the record for any future investigations or trials. However, while many districts use grand juries as fact-finding missions, regardless of the imminence of a criminal trial, Carol's experience with Cook County is that the court system only convenes them when they're also ready to bring criminal charges. One reason Cook County could be reticent to call these witnesses, he believes, is that if their stories were to change between the grand jury and a potential criminal trial, it would be easier for defense attorneys to discredit them. But as one of the few people who has gained the family's trust, listened to their statements, and feels confident in their testimony, he thinks it is a risk worth taking. Chicago District Attorney Kim Fox has the power to reconsider the value of a grand jury in this case, but her office seems to be following in the path of her predecessors. In a statement to Oprah Daily, her office said, "The Cook County State's Attorney's Office has not been asked to review criminal charges related to the disappearance of Diamond and Tianda Bradley. We are open to reviewing any information that is brought to us by law enforcement who is handling the investigation of this case." The FBI, for its part, remains interested in the case, but identified the Chicago Police Department as the lead investigative agency. The FBI is still actively providing investigative assistance to the Chicago Police Department with respect to the disappearance of Diamond and Tyonda Bradley, says Special Agent Siobhan Johnson of the FBI's Chicago office. We continue to seek the public's assistance in identifying tips and offer a $10,000 reward for Diamond and Tyonda. As Carol points out, criminal charges are not required to call a grand jury, and in a case like this, where the single thing that might bring it back to life is new information, it could be the best or only way forward. Several tantalizing leads have surfaced over the years. The first in 2008 was a MySpace photo nearly identical to law enforcement's age-progressed pictures of Tyonda. Sheila brought in a well-known forensic artist who believed that the girls were one and the same. Eventually, however, the identity of the girl in the photo was determined, and it was not Tyonda. The girls keep in touch with Sheila, though, hoping for positive news. In 2019, after Sheila posted a plea for the girls to come home on Facebook, a woman in Texas responded, "We're trying." When Sheila began to message her, asking for specifics, though, the woman's story soon became suspect. She became highly aggravated and disappointed at the same time, Sheila said at the time. She said, "Auntie, of all the people, you should know this is me." It was a hoax. Sheila has taken on the search with extraordinary devotion. On March 20, 2015, she was driving a long westward stretch through Wisconsin after helping her daughter move. An emergency alert flashed on her phone. 10-year-old Barway Collins was missing from Crystal, Minnesota, where Sheila still lives. "Not in my backyard," she said to herself as she urged the truck on a little faster toward home. "Not in my damn backyard." The next morning, moved by the same drive that made her sit in her van night after night all those years ago, Sheila made flyers for posting and stood with a bullhorn outside the apartment building where Barway lived, exhorting his neighbors to join the search. For 3 straight Saturdays, she organized hundreds of volunteers to canvass the surrounding area. When it was revealed that Barway's father's cell phone had pinged near the Mississippi River the morning of the boy's disappearance, and then again 20 minutes after he was last seen alive, Sheila redirected the search to its shoreline and the nearby railroad tracks. The police had already traversed part of the area, but Sheila had a gut feeling the boy was there. It was sunny, but the temperature hovered just above freezing in the early hours of April 11th. Sheila leaned out the window, cigarette smoke drifting up toward the sky. The boy was still missing. "Barway," she said to whoever might be listening, "Barway, you gotta help me today." As she prepared to organize the day's canvas, she brought blue and white balloons to release, blue for Barway, white for her prayers. The various search factions set off. Sheila herself was visiting a nearby building that housed sex offenders, hoping someone would have information to share. When she returned to her van to collect more flyers, her phone rang. "Is this Miss Smith?" It was a young boy. For a moment, in Sheila's heart, it was Barway, safe and alive. Your mind can play tricks on you that way when you're looking so hard for so long for one thing. The boy continued, "I'm with the searchers and we're by the Mississippi." A troop of Boy Scouts had joined the search and one of them was calling the report, seeing lots of stuff like fishing poles and garbage. Sheila thanked him and urged him to continue looking. He called back, "Miss Smith, either this is a big old tree or it might be a body." Barway's body was still partially bound with duct tape. It wrapped around his abdomen, through his arms, had broken free and floated stiffly away from his torso like branches. The average water temperature hovers around 40 degrees that time of year, but decomposition was well underway. Sheila walked the riverbank near where, she would later learn, the boy's father had left his body after striking him. She fell to her knees among the trees and bushes and again asked through her tears, "How could you let me find someone else's but not my own?" The shape of a loved one's absence changes from person to person. Tracy sees the girls in motion. The long, graceful limbs of ballerinas remind her of the love of dance she and Tyonda shared. Looking at the couch, she can see Diamond leaping from cushion to cushion. For Rita, the absence is shaped like a bowl of rainbow-streaked milk left over from Millville Fruity Rice cereal. One hot summer day, Tyonda had snatched the last milk carton at lunch, and Rita thought she would have to go without. Instead, when Tianda finished her cereal, she saved the colorful milk for her older sister. The memory still makes Rita cry. She says Tianda was different from most other kids her age, generous and kind, a good sister. These moments, bittersweet in retrospect, now compete with the other legacy that Diamond and Tianda have left behind, which is one of fear. It has made both childhood and motherhood fraught for the Bradleys, affecting three generations of women and their children. When she was young, Rita worried that whoever took Diamond and Tianda might return to kidnap her and their other sister, Victoria. Now a mother herself, it is fear for her own children. Her oldest is 12, the same age she was when her sisters vanished. "It makes me stricter," Rita says. "I don't let them go to people's houses that aren't family members." Tracy, too, has become more protective and more fearful, even as her children become parents themselves. And she has had to navigate those changes while under the critical eye of the public. "I'm not a bad mom," she says, her voice rising with passion. "I know who Tracy Bradley is. I know who I am, and I don't let that reflect on me or my kids or my life because I'm still a good mom." Even without their physical presence, she is still a mother to Diamond and Tianda. "You were always a mother," she says. For Sheila, the loss has changed her in ways both personal and professional. "I've never taken a job since they were kidnapped that couldn't provide me with some kind of information or a way to keep an eye on everybody," she says. "I don't take jobs unless I'm able to obtain information." She's been a public aid caseworker and worked in the pediatric ward of a hospital, hoping that one day the girls or someone with information about them might come through. It is, she says, part of being a desperate auntie. You have people saying, "Well, the auntie does more than the mom," Sheila says, disbelief in her voice. And I'm saying, "What's the difference? We're family." Every year as the 6th of July approaches, the preparations begin anew, stopping at the copy shop to pick up fresh banners and colored flyers featuring images of the girls and pleas for their return. Ordering t-shirts from the custom shop pressed with Diamond and Tianda's faces outlined by a heart. Picking up balloons, sometimes purple and white, sometimes pink and yellow, to release against the blue summer sky. There are variations. One year it was floating lanterns instead of balloons. Another time, doves flew into the afternoon air. Last year, the family had COVID-19 face masks printed along with the shirts. Sheila and several other members of the family usually meet early in the afternoon near the new 35th Street Bridge, which has replaced the one they crossed so many years ago as they search for their girls. Though the main event is moved to a park farther south, the Bradleys do not want their old neighborhood to forget their pain or their hope. The girls are still gone, but someone could still come forward. Later, crowds begin to arrive for the vigil at the park on 47th. Motorcycle brigades and lifelong friends, family members, and Facebook followers all converge on one of the wide green fields under the July sun. There are hymns and hosannas, Tracy sometimes lifting her hand as she sings, as though it might help a mother's prayers reach a higher plane. Then the release of balloons, and with them the stasis of unresolved grief, making way for the possibility of something fresh, a tip, a clue, a confession. Maybe this will be the year. Grills are fired, coolers set out, children too young to know Diamond and Tianda through anything but family lore scamper across the playground while their parents eat and laugh. Often there is a cake for Victoria, whose birthday is the next day. Afternoon passes into evening, and sometimes a beat cop arrives to remind the family that the park is closed. They pack up the banners and coolers and children and reconvene at someone's apartment, where they drink a bit to ease the pain. The nature of their grief may have evolved over the years, but it has never lessened. "We don't get past July 6th of 2001, Sheila says. "It's the same feeling, but it hurts a little more because then we realize that it has been almost 20 years. We relive that day every day. It doesn't change." What began as a solitary hour-by-hour vigil, cigarettes and soda in a silent parking lot at dawn, is now measured in years. The year Tracy moved away from 35th and Cottage Grove, unable to bear the memories. The year a Boy Scout found Barway, but nobody found Diamond or Tianda. The year Rita became a mother and couldn't share the joy with two of her sisters. 20 years sitting in that van, peering out at the world, watching everyone who passes by and whispering the same question over and over. Was it you? Was it you? Was it you? Our next article is an excerpt from Oprah and Dr. Bruce Perry's book on trauma and resilience. This past April, Oprah and renowned brain and trauma expert Dr. Bruce Perry released What Happened to You? Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing, a collaborative work that seeks to understand the often hidden complexities of childhood trauma, how those wounds persist in later years, and how we can better understand those psychic injuries in order to move forward. Following, we'll read an excerpt from the introduction to the book, which unfolds as a dialogue between Oprah and Dr. Perry. Oprah: "Stop your crying," she would warn. "You better hush your mouth." My face settled into stoic. My heart stopped racing, biting hard into my lower lip so no words would escape me. "I do this because I love you," she'd repeat, her defense in my ear. As a young girl, I was whooped regularly. At the time, it was accepted practice for caregivers to use corporal punishment to discipline a child. My grandmother, Hattie Mae, embraced it. But even at 3 years old, I knew that what I was experiencing was wrong. One of the worst beatings I recall happened on a Sunday morning. Going to church played a major role in our lives. Just before we were to leave for service, I was sent to the well behind our house to pump water. The farmhouse where I lived with my grandparents did not have indoor plumbing. From the window, my grandmother caught a glimpse of me twirling my fingers in the water and became enraged. Though I was only daydreaming, innocently as any child might, she was angry because this was our drinking water and I had put my fingers in it. She then asked me if I had been playing in the water and I said no. She bent me over and whipped me so violently my flesh welted. Afterward, I managed to put on my white Sunday best dress. Blood began to seep through and stain the crisp fabric a deep crimson. Livid at the sight, she chastised me for getting blood on my dress, then sent me to Sunday school. In the rural South, this is how black children were raised. There wasn't anyone I knew who wasn't whooped. I was beaten for the slightest reasons. Spilled water, a broken glass, the inability to keep quiet or still. I heard a black comedian once say, "The longest walk is to get your own switch." I not only had to walk to get the switch, but if there wasn't one available, I had to go find one. A thin, young branch worked best, but if it was too thin, I would have to braid two or three together to make it stronger. She often forced me to help her braid the switch. Sometimes the whoopings would get saved up for Saturday night when I was naked and freshly bathed. Afterwards, when I could barely stand, she would tell me to wipe that pout off my face and start smiling. Bury it as though it never happened. Eventually, I developed a keen sense of when trouble was brewing. I recognized the shift in my grandmother's voice or the look that meant I had displeased her. She was not a mean person. I believed she cared for me and wanted me to be a good girl. And I understood that hushing my mouth or silence was the only way to ensure a quick end to punishment and pain. For the next 40 years, that pattern of conditioned compliance, the result of deeply rooted trauma, would define every relationship, interaction, and decision in my life. The long-term impact of being whooped, then forced to hush and even smile about it, turned me into a world-class people-pleaser for most of my life. It would not have taken me half a lifetime to learn to set boundaries and say no with confidence had I been nurtured differently. As an adult, I am grateful to enjoy long-term, consistent, loving relationships with many people. Yet the early beatings, emotional fractures, and splintered connections that I experienced with the central figures in my early life no doubt helped develop my solitary independence. In the powerful words of the poem Invictus, "I am the captain of my soul and master of my fate." Millions of people were treated just as I was as children and grew up believing their lives were of no value. My conversations with Dr. Bruce Perry and the thousands of people who were brave enough to share their stories with me on the Oprah Winfrey Show have taught me that the effects of my treatment by those who were supposed to care for me weren't strictly emotional. There was also a biological response. Through my work with Dr. Perry, my eyes have been opened to the fact that although I experienced abuse and trauma as a child, my brain found ways to adapt. This is where hope lives for all of us, in the unique adaptability of our miraculous brains. As Dr. Perry explains in the book, understanding how the brain reacts to stress or early trauma helps clarify how what has happened to us in the past shapes who we are, how we behave, and why we do the things we do. Through this lens, we can build a renewed sense of personal self-worth and ultimately recalibrate our responses to circumstances, situations, and relationships. It is, in other words, the key to reshaping our very lives. Dr. Perry. One morning in 1989, I was sitting in my lab, the Laboratory of Developmental Neurosciences at the University of Chicago, looking at the results of a recent experiment when my lab assistant poked his head into my office. "Oprah's calling you." "Yeah, right. Take a message." I'd been up all night writing. The results of the experiment looked messed up. I wasn't in the mood for a practical joke. He smirked. "No, really, it's somebody from Harpo." There was no possible reason for Oprah to call me. I was a young academic child psychiatrist studying the impact of stress and trauma on development. Only a handful of people knew about my work. Most of my psychiatry peers didn't think much about the neurosciences or childhood trauma. The role of trauma as a major factor in physical and mental health was unexplored. I thought one of my friends was simply pranking me, but I took the call. Ms. Winfrey is convening a meeting of national leaders in the area of child abuse in Washington in 2 weeks. We would like you to attend. After more explanation, it became clear that the meeting would be attended by many well-known and well-established people and organizations. My work, studying the impact of trauma on the developing brain, would be lost among more politically accepted dominant perspectives. I politely declined. Several weeks later, I received another call. "Oprah is inviting you to a day-long retreat at her farm in Indiana. There will be two other people, you and Oprah. We want to brainstorm solutions to the issue of child abuse." This time, with a chance to meaningfully contribute, I accepted. The dominant voice that day was Andrew Vox, an author and attorney specializing in representing children. His pioneering work highlighted the need to track known child abusers. At that point, they could move from state to state, and there was no way to keep tabs on where they were or if they were complying with restrictions to avoid children. Our 1989 meeting in Indiana led to the 1991 drafting of the National Child Protection Act to establish a national database of convicted child abusers. On December 20, 1993, after 2 years of advocacy that included testifying before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, the Oprah Bill was signed into law. That day in 1989 led to many more conversations. Some took place on the Oprah Winfrey Show to discuss specific children's stories and campaigns on the importance of early childhood and brain development. Most of our conversations, however, were in the context of the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls, or OLLAG, which Oprah founded in South Africa in 2007. This remarkable institution was created to select, support, educate, and enrich disadvantaged girls with high potential. The explicit intention was to create a cadre of future leaders. Many of these girls had demonstrated resilience and high academic achievement despite a range of adversities, including poverty, traumatic loss, and community or intrafamily violence. Early on, the school began to act on many of the concepts we discuss in this book. Today, OWLAG is becoming a model of a trauma-sensitive, developmentally aware educational setting. In 2018, I sat down with Oprah for a 60-minute story about trauma-informed care. Though only 2 minutes of our conversation ended up in the final segment, millions of people were watching and listening, and the excitement created in the community of professionals working in trauma was remarkable. But there is so much more to say. The enthusiasm for our conversation was in part a reflection of Oprah's own enthusiasm for the importance of this topic. On CBS This Morning, Oprah told Gayle King that she would dance on tabletops to get people to pay attention to the impact of trauma on the developing brains of children. In a CBS News supplement to the 60 Minutes show, Oprah called it the most important story of her life. Oprah has been talking about abuse, neglect, and healing for her entire career. Her dedication to educating people about trauma-related topics has been a hallmark of her shows. Millions of people have watched Oprah listen to, connect with, console, and learn from people with experience or expertise in trauma of all kinds. She has explored the impacts of traumatic loss, maltreatment, sexual abuse, racism, misogyny, domestic violence, community violence, gender and sexual identity issues, false imprisonment, and so much more. And through this has helped us explore health, healing, post-traumatic growth, and resilience. For 25 years, The Oprah Winfrey Show took a deep and thoughtful look at developmental adversity, challenge, distress, stress, trauma, and resilience. She explored dissociative identity disorder in 1989, the importance of early childhood experiences on brain development in 1997, the rights of adopted children in 2005, the impact of severe neglect in 2009, and much more. In many ways, her show paved the way for a larger systemic awareness of these issues. Her final season included an episode featuring 200 men, including Tyler Perry, disclosing their histories of sexual abuse. She has been and will continue to be a champion and guide for people impacted by adversity and trauma. Oprah and I have been talking about trauma, the brain, resilience, and healing for more than 30 years. And this book is, in many ways, the culmination of those talks. It uses conversation and human stories to illuminate the science that underlies it all. There are far too many aspects of development, the brain, and trauma to cover in one book, especially a book written through stories. The language and concepts used in this book translate the work of thousands of scientists, clinicians, and researchers in fields ranging from genetics to epidemiology to anthropology. It is a book for anyone and everyone. The title, What Happened to You, signifies a shift in perspective that honors the power of the past to shape our current functioning. The phrase originated in the pioneering work group of Dr. Sandra Bloom, developer of the Sanctuary Model. In Dr. Bloom's words, we, the treatment team for Sanctuary, were in a team meeting sometime around 1991 on our inpatient unit, trying to describe the change that had happened to us in recognizing and responding to the issue of trauma, especially what has become known now as childhood adversity, as a casual issue for the problems of most of the people we were treating. And Joe Fodoraro, LCSW, always good at pithy observations, said, "It's that we have changed our fundamental question from what's wrong with you to what happened to you." Oprah and I are convinced that asking the fundamental question, what happened to you, can help each of us know a little more about how experiences, both good and bad, shape us. Our hope in sharing these stories and scientific concepts is that every reader will, in their own way, gain insights to help us all live better, more fulfilling lives. Our next article by Amanda Jetty Knox is titled, My Trans Wife and Daughter Taught Me How to Finally Love My Body. On a rare night out after having my first baby, a woman shouted out of a car window at me on a busy downtown street. Fat cow, she yelled, then threw her head back and laughed. I stood amongst my partner and friends stunned into silence as she drove away. I was in my early 20s, at my heaviest weight, and her words had hit me like a brick to my stretch-marked stomach. A few weeks later, I took my young son to the beach for the first time, holding his hands to help him balance while he wobbled in the sand. Two college-age guys suntanned near us. "Check out the beached whale," one of them said loudly, staring right at me. I looked away, pretending not to hear them. Like many bigger people, my life has been speckled with painful encounters like these. They made me ashamed of who I am, disgusted with my body, and unable to associate the word beauty with myself in any way. But the way I felt, filled with shame and self-loathing, is not the way I feel today. Today I feel stronger. I am stronger. This shift in perspective all began 5 years ago, the night my 11-year-old daughter proclaimed she was a girl. If someone had asked me to describe my family prior to 2014, I would have proudly stated, we're a mom, a dad, and three boys. But one cold Canadian evening in late February, our middle child, who had struggled for years with depression, anxiety, and increasing isolation, wrote us an email to say we had gotten it all wrong. We were not raising a son, but a daughter. She needed to live as the girl she really was. We were immediately supportive, but also worried. What did this mean for her future? A quick online search revealed countless stories of bullying, harassment, and violence towards transgender people. Because of stigma and discrimination, trans youth have a higher rate of attempted suicide. Gender dysphoria, a feeling of distress many trans people experience, can further impact mental health. My head was swimming with this new information, trying not to drown in it. For years, I didn't know how to help this child who was so clearly struggling. Now she could finally explain what was hurting her. It was time for me to help her thrive and learn to love herself, but first I had to teach myself that same lesson. I had always tried to model confidence for my children. I put on a good show, but a closer look would reveal the illusion. I stayed out of family photos and dreaded clothes shopping. I avoided mirrors and the stack of dusty weight loss books on the shelf, and under no circumstances would I set foot in a gym. Gyms, as far as I was concerned, were ruled by those with fast metabolisms. The few times I had gone to one, I felt the heat of others' gazes. I was the big girl on the treadmill, going far slower than anyone else, but breathing just as hard. I was the woman who wouldn't do a lunge for fear of falling over and had trouble mastering certain yoga poses because my stomach would get in the way. I hid in a stall when I got dressed in the changing room and worked out at the back of the few fitness classes I dared to try. At the gym, I always felt like someone's before picture, the one they hold up next to their after photo so others can gasp and comment on how far they've come. Gyms aren't for me, I would say with an air of I'm above this, but what I really meant was that I didn't belong there. No, I was not confident, no matter what I was trying to make my daughter believe. But more than ever, I needed to be a true example of self-love. I had just found out I had a transgender preteen facing obstacles I couldn't imagine. As awful as it was, no amount of name-calling or fat-shaming on the beach could compare to what she might face in her lifetime. How could I teach her to love herself unconditionally, no matter what the world might throw at her? The only way was to model it, and so I had to learn to love myself unconditionally, too. I decided to approach my own healing the same way I would help someone else who was trying to heal from a lifetime of hurt, with patience and kindness. I promised myself that from this moment on, everything I did would be grounded in love. This included what food choices I made. There would be no negative self-talk, no guilt, no impossibly strict rules, and no declarations of failure. I would eat mindfully to the point of feeling satiated and not overstuffed. I would do it for both pleasure and nutrition. For the first time since childhood, there was no guilt attached to food. I felt set free. When it came to fitness, any exercise I did would be something I enjoyed and could maintain long term. I wouldn't set impossibly high goals, but ease into things gently. I would work out for how it made me feel, not how it might make me look. I would try not to compare myself to others, but instead keep my fitness journey deeply personal. I soon discovered strength training and quickly fell for it. While running was hard on my joints and not something I excelled at, lifting weights reminded me I was powerful. But no matter how good I felt, I was riddled with insecurity in the strength training classes. I was by far the biggest body there. I still forced myself to go, but felt out of place, wanting nothing more than to be invisible. It would take a wake-up call to shed the last of the pain I had been carrying around my whole life. The year after my daughter came out, my partner did too. For 18 years, I thought I was married to a man. That's what she wanted the world to think. The idea of coming out as transgender terrified her. She had seen too many stories of divorce and job losses, open discrimination, and violent assaults. But when she could no longer keep living in a role that didn't fit, the person I knew as my husband told me she was, in fact, my wife. The news flowed through me like a wave of cold shock. Could this really be happening a second time? The makeup of our family as I knew it had changed again. My wife Zoe is beautiful. At 6 feet tall, with a slim frame, chestnut brown hair, an infectious smile, and impeccable fashion sense, She looks like she just stepped out of a magazine. I am smitten with her today in a way I never was before, in part because she's no longer hiding. The real Zoe, loved and accepted for who she is, laughs more and engages with the world on a deeper level. She's radiant, truly lovely, but she doesn't always feel that way. Despite everything my wife has going for her, gender dysphoria will sometimes still cast its dark shadow on her, leaving her incapable of seeing the beauty the rest of us see. It might be the sound of her voice one day, her frustration over having larger feet the next. At times I'll find her in front of the mirror, agonizing over facial traits she deems too masculine. Dysphoria, particularly early in her transition, could reduce her to tears. My daughter went through the same thing. It's a feeling I can only relate to the discomfort I felt for so long within my own body, and even that pales in comparison to what they must be experiencing. But despite those feelings, and despite the discrimination they face in our society, my wife and daughter continue to live their lives without apology. I have two shining examples in my home that have reshaped the way I think about beauty. Should beauty be measured in dress size or strength of character? Is flawless skin more attractive than an authentic smile? When someone judges another for who they are, doesn't their ugliness say far more about them than the person they're judging? Alexis and Zoe showed me what beauty really is. It's strength, resiliency, and authenticity. It's nothing the media had taught me and everything the world is now showing me. They opened my eyes and empowered me. And through them, I was able to shed the last thread of self-loathing so true confidence could take root. Now at 42, after 4 years of exercise and mindful eating, my body is reshaped. My blood pressure is healthy and I have an athletic heart rate. I've lost some weight and inches, but I'm by no means a small person. I've learned being fit does not always equal being thin, and I'm at peace with that. I love what my body can do, and most of the time, I love the way it looks. I've come a long way. Today, I'm a regular at my local gym. I walk in with confidence, greeting staff and other regulars. In an effort to normalize larger bodies, I now work out at the front of all my strength training classes, where I'm almost always the biggest person there. I stare proudly in the full-length mirrors while I exercise, knowing I generally lift more weight than everyone else in the class. This accomplishment through regular training could not have happened if I didn't overcome my own demons. Insecurity would have hustled me out that door before I could see what I'm capable of. Our society's unrealistic standard of beauty is only a standard if we all buy into it. If we challenge it, if we broaden it, we can change it. I want to think the three women in my family are all challenging those standards in our own ways. My daughter is growing up without the need to hide who she is for a lifetime. My wife, tired of hiding for far too many years, gets up every day and lives her truth. They're examples to all of us. And me? Well, I'm at the front of the class, lifting heavy, breaking a sweat, and loving what I see in the mirror. Heaven help anyone who tries to bring me down. I'm reshaping society's idea of an after picture, and I'm proud of it. We'll end this week with an article by Nadine Jolie Courtney. Some fun fall activities to try this year besides apple picking. Make homemade candy apples. So many of fall's greatest delights trigger memories of childhood nostalgia. Indulge in the old-school treat of candy apples by making your own with a variety of yummy toppings. Rent a boat for the afternoon. Taking to the seas, or rivers or oceans, is a great way to leaf peep from a fresh angle. No vessel, no problem. You can rent one from Boat Setter, which connects you to local boat owners so you can take their craft for a spin for the day, with or without a captain, your choice. And don't worry, insurance is included with the price of your rental. Jump in a pile of leaves. Embrace your inner kid by diving into a massive pile of leaves. Or make a game of it with family or friends by hiding treasure and turning it into a scavenger hunt. Just be sure to shower after if any dogs enjoy your yard, and check for bugs. Throw a scavenger hunt. The pumpkin patch, the apple orchard, or even your own backyard are all perfect locations for a fun fall scavenger hunt. Make printouts of your items and be sure to have a treat ready for the winter. Run a fall 5K. Autumn's cooler weather makes it an ideal time for a fun run. Sign up for a fall 5K or a turkey trot, the perfect way to get moving before that big Thanksgiving dinner. Roast s'mores. Sometimes it's the simplest pastimes that create the best memories. Gather your family or friends around the campfire for good company and s'mores. Don't have access to a fire? Get creative by using your kitchen stove or even a candle to roast marshmallows. Go horseback riding. Saddle up. From the top of a horse is one of the best ways to enjoy fall's stunning foliage, gently trotting through autumnal leaves and following trails through woods and over streams. Decorate your porch for Halloween. Try an easy Halloween do-it-yourself to make your home look inviting, or if you're not into the holidays, simply lean into a pumpkin motif. Go for a hayride. Picking pumpkins isn't the only way to celebrate fall at your local farm. The most underrated activity of all? A hayride that allows the whole family to kick back, relax, and enjoy the sights. Feeling brave? At night, many farms offer haunted hayrides, so grab your friends and prepare for bone-chilling chainsaws, creepy clowns, and shocking sights aplenty. Pick produce at a farmer's market. Farmers markets rotate out produce seasonally, which means you can find unique and tasty picks in the fall to add to your roasts and desserts. Look for things like Jerusalem artichokes, cranberries, figs, pomegranates, and of course, apples and pumpkins. Rent a cabin. Whether in the mountains or in the woods, a rustic cabin, complete with fireplace, of course, is one of the quickest paths to feeling like fall is truly in the air. Fire up Airbnb to find affordable options in your area. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.